This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. On April 23rd, the body of 22-year-old Sunil Tripathi was discovered in the waters off a park in Providence, Rhode Island. He had taken a leave of absence from Brown University, where he was a student, had disappeared on March 16th, and had been struggling with depression. His family used YouTube and Facebook during those weeks that he was missing in hopes that they would find him. Instead, after Reddit and Twitter users misidentified Sunil as one of the Boston Marathon bombers, the Tripathi family was bombarded with threatening and hateful posts and fielded numerous calls from media outlets asking for interviews. The false story exploded all over the web and almost just as quickly disappeared. We invited the Tripathi family to join us on Radio Times to talk about Sunil, what they learned about social media, and what can be done to address the problem of depression. And let me introduce the three of them to you. Judy Tripathi is a certified diabetes educator, registered dietitian, runs a private practice for intensive diabetes management. And Judy Tripathi, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you here. Also with us is Ravi Tripathi. He's a student at Temple University School of Medicine here in Philadelphia, worked for 2 years in AmeriCorps in Philadelphia's public schools. Ravi Tripathi, nice to have you with us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Also with us is Sangeeta Tripathi. She works in global public health with NGOs, with foundations, and the UN to improve healthcare access in the developing world. And Sangeeta, nice to have you with us on Radio Times
as well.
Good morning. Let me begin with you, if I could, Judy. And I have to say, I read about your family and you in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, thinking, having read that article, that we could have you on this show. And I'm surprised and pleased that all of you are here. And your husband, I know, could not be with us, Akhil. Why is it important for you to tell Sunil's story?
The whole experience we had with Sunil was very public and shared. Our strength in moving forward came from support from other people. We know that a lot of people and a lot of families struggle with family members who are depressed, and the more visibility we can get, the better. We were very pleased to be invited.
Well, we're pleased to have you here, and I want to pick up on all of that. And let me turn to you, Ravi, if I could. What was Sunil like?
Sunil was absolutely my best friend growing up. He's 4 years younger than me, and we did everything together. He was always at my side, always willing to do whatever I was kind of eager to do as his big brother. You know, we did a lot of playing outside. We played soccer in the living room, much more than my mother would have liked growing up, and wrestled, and, you know, just, you know, kind of we're two kids exploring the world, and he was just always the little brother that was right next to me.
And Sangeeta, he was a philosophy major at Brown, also played the saxophone.
He was. All three of us actually went to Brown, and Sunil, my youngest brother, outshined us all. He would get straight A's without seemingly to even trying, get in very deeply complicated logical reasoning arguments from his philosophy training, was a beautiful saxophone player, and just a really fun kid full of life.
And how would you describe him as the mom?
Oh, ditto to everything his brother and sister said. Sunil was very sensitive, did not do anything without thinking about it. Sort of an artistic personality, can be a little eccentric, very logical. As the kids have said, he was my baby.
Mm. As you said, and as we learned, the little that we know about Sunil is that he struggled with depression. Was that something that he had through his life or came later on in high school, college?
I don't think he had it earlier in life. It really became apparent after about 2 years at Brown. And again, we were 300 miles away, so we probably didn't pick it up immediately, but in the middle of his third year, he was showing signs of being depressed. It's a very lonely disease. He was not one to communicate a lot. I think that's part of the whole dilemma. We were giving him a lot of family support. He did admit to his depression. The real difficulty was he was not willing to go for help. We did have him talk to a few people, but he sort of decided he was going to deal with it himself, even though we knew that was probably not the way.
To you, Ravi, you describe, you know, wrestling with your brother, your younger brother, Sunil. Did you see signs of depression?
Absolutely. I think as a family we all did, and it manifested itself in many ways, from seeing us less and communicating with us less, to losing interest in playing music and other things that had previously provided a lot of excitement for him. As my mother said, it provided a big challenge for us and for him.
How about for you, Sangeeta?
Yeah, I mean, I really reflect all those things. A lot of reading that we've been doing during, when we were trying to help Sunny, Sunil, and since about depression, talks about depression removing people's capacity to give or receive affection and to be able to be connected to one another. And I think we saw a lot of that play out. And one of the things that we've learned a lot is just how prevalent depression is among young people. They talk about, more than 1 in 10 young people, more than 25% of kids under 22 have had depressive episodes, and that suicide is the second leading cause of death of college students. So a lot of the things that that we saw were things that are actually just really, really common, and we didn't fully understand how serious and how possible, just how vulnerable young people are.
And Judy, he was on a leave of absence, right? Was that in part because school was too much for him?
Yes. He completed 3 years, and the whole family urged him to take a leave, and he was ready at that point. He wanted to stay in the college town. His friends were there, and that was very, very important to him. It was a little difficult for us.
Sure.
We made a lot
so
of trips
away.
To Providence.
But he didn't want to talk, or he would talk sporadically?
Sunil, even at best, was not a big talker. Most of his thinking was kept sort of to himself. He didn't want to talk about personal things because he knew he was in trouble. We did consult with a psychiatrist during this time, trying to figure out better ways to help him. I mean, we as the family, Sunil was unwilling to go to a therapist. But he had a lot of family support through texting and phone and email. So we were very intent on not making him feel isolated from the family.
Right.
And he had a lot of, a handful of friends who were close.
And just to add,
this,
as
please.
A sister, he was in contact with different members of our family and friends every single day. And even on the last day before he went missing, he spent the whole afternoon with his best college friend. And she, as we were began the search, had no idea that anything was different the next day than the day before. So again, this raises in our mind the fact that despite regular, absolutely daily contact with many, many, many people, people can still be really struggling underneath that.
And he did disappear, Ravi, on March 16th.
Yeah. What seemed to be just another Friday night with friends and then talking to a couple family members. On Saturday, his friend at college tried to contact him and just couldn't get a hold of him. Didn't think too much of it at the time. And then Sunday morning, managed to be let into his room by some housemates and realized that he wasn't there, and his cell phone was there and his wallet was there, which were very unusual signs. So she calls us up, and on March 17th, we as a family drove up there, and that kind of started our time in Providence. Mm-hmm.
Well, and in part, this is about social media. As you said, Sangeeta, he stayed in touch, texting and emailing. And I know the family, all of you, put up this Facebook page to try to reach out to him. And Sangeeta, you brought in these extraordinary photos of people from all over the world who wanted to help you.
Yeah. So just to paint a little bit of that arc, young people use Facebook, and we started immediately when we spoke with police. They suggested to look everywhere where Sunil used to go frequently. So we were sort of crowdsourcing information about where to look. That very quickly turned into a Facebook page that was our hub of all of our organizing efforts. People literally downloaded missing posters and hung them up in Philadelphia area, in New York City, in Boston. People were adding ideas and comments into maps to suggest places to look. People were providing words of love and support and memories of Sunil, and people were speaking directly to Sunil. Mm. So that hub grew to over 1 million viewers. It was an incredible, incredible mass of love. And after the horrible events of the misidentification, we actually started changing the tone on our Facebook page, and we started putting up a few little hand messages where people just would write with Sharpie on the palm of their hand a little note to Sunil in the spirit of lending their hand both to our family and to each other. And literally, we got, in the span of 5 days, over 600 pictures that people and stories that people shared through Facebook. And, you know, it was a really sign to us of the latent love that exists that sort of, you know, we were able to capture through Facebook.
In fact, let me read one. This is from Melbourne, Australia. We see a hand, it looks like a woman in prayer and a candle, and on this person's hand, love is flowing to you and your family from the whole world. I mean, Judy, it must have been extraordinary to hear from strangers that were so concerned about your family and, of course, about Sunil.
It totally was, Marty. It is one of the best memories for us to keep from this whole episode. As Sangeeta said, the support, I guess the best way to say it is, it made me realize how good people are. I mean, really, in their hearts, I would go to the post office in Providence, and the postmistress would come around her desk to give me a hug. She said, "I saw you on the news last night." Everywhere we went, we were stopped. Providence is a pretty small town feel, especially on College Hill, and everyone knew our story. People stopped us on the sidewalk. And in the course of that, a lot of people opened up about depression and suicide in their families, among their friends. It was both stunning and inspiring and sobering.
Indeed. And we're almost having a break here. I'd be curious, Ravi, what you experienced.
I mean, it was really a roller coaster. Social media provided an absolute roller coaster for us. From the first moment when we used it as a search tool to the moment when we opened up our computers, logged on our Facebook page, and saw people equating Sunil to one of the Boston bombers, to the days after that, seeing these hand messages, to even after that, with, you know, seeing people send messages of love, both long-lost family, friends, people from, you know, that almost hadn't realized, still were aware of us, to random strangers.
Let me pick up on all of that. That's Ravi Tripathi, also with us, Sangeeta Tripathi and Judy Tripathi. And we're talking about a number of things, including Judy's son, Sunil. He died earlier this year and was misidentified as one of the Boston Marathon bombers. We'll be right back.
The Garden State Wine Growers Association supports WHYY and presents the Jersey Fresh Wine Festival, Saturday and Sunday, September 7th and 8th, on the Burlington County Fairgrounds. 18 wineries will provide sampling of more than 250 locally produced wines. The festival, taking place from noon to 5 on both days, will also feature live music, crafts, and food vendors. Full details for the Jersey Fresh Wine Festival at NewJerseyWines.com.
The WHYY Connections Festival is back Saturday and Sunday, September 7th and 8th at the Great Plaza on Penn's Landing. Saturday rocks with headliners They Might Be Giants, Ben Queller, and more. And Sunday switches to the sound of Philly Soul with the Soul Survivors, Sensational Soul Cruisers, and again, more. Both days are free and open to the public. The 2013 WHYY Connections Festival. Learn more and register online at whyy.org/connectionsfestival.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, anthropologists were supposed to help the U.S. military win hearts and minds in Iraq and Afghanistan. A reporter says these human terrain teams were working against the odds.
The moment to learn about people in the places where we're fighting is not in the middle of a war.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1, on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. As we all know, social media can be a cause for good or for ill. It was used to try to find Sunil Tripathi, who disappeared in Providence, Rhode Island, where he was a student at Brown University in March. Shortly after that, Sunil Tripathi was identified as one of the Boston Marathon suicide bombers. He and his family created a Facebook page, or I should say his family had created a Facebook page in an attempt to find him, and they had to take it down because of all the nasty and threatening posts. Of course, he was not one of the marathon bombers, and we are talking with his mother, Judy Tripathi, his brother, Ravi, and his sister, Sangeeta, about lessons learned about social media and about depression as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Sangeeta, I read that you and Ravi had gone to the Boston Marathon. You had a friend who was running in the marathon, yes?
We did. We had been searching for Sunil night and day for about 29 days when the Boston Marathon happened, and one of our friends who had joined in the search, we really wanted to go and support him. He was running. And so in the spirit of community that we were really trying to help build, we decided to take our first half-day break from the search since we begun, to take a mini vacation, and went to Boston. And little did we know, you know, the events that transpired, we were very, very shaken, as was our family, of course. And that was actually right around the one-month marker of Sunil's disappearance. Wow. We were in the process of thinking about how to keep re-energizing the campaign and keeping people's eyes out for Sunil. And we had a bunch of different ideas. And, of course, we held everything out of respect for what was happening in Boston. Little did we know how the two stories would become interwoven a few days later.
Can you talk about how they became interwoven?
Absolutely. In the search for Sunil, we worked very hard to get his face and his story out in front of many eyes as humanly possible. And in the Northeast, when people were trying to investigate or trying to really learn more about who the Boston bombers were, those photos, these very fuzzy photos, were released by the FBI. And a few people put together a very, very fuzzy, low-resolution photo of a skinny boy with a baseball cap and my brother. And, you know, I think in the fear and frenzy of trying to figure out what was going on, to feel safe, to feel valuable, individuals with very easy media tools in front of them started saying, these two skinny people look like the same person, to, these two skinny people are the same person. And that leap was made very quickly. And that night, you know, in the hours of darkness, the night of April 18th, turned into a absolute, absolute frenzy.
I bet. And nightmare, I would say, Judy, yes?
It was a nightmare. And it's funny to look back on it because now we can sort of analyze it, but living through it, it was evolving around us, and we had no idea, really how it was happening. None of us slept that night. There were a lot of friends in the house and family. Kids were on the computer constantly. We did have very good support from the FBI agent who was assigned to our case. But it was frightening. It was frightening.
I mean, to watch this false story involving your son just getting tweeted and retweeted, and all of a sudden it becomes the narrative. Can you talk a bit about that, Robbie?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had used Facebook and social media to our advantage, to such a great advantage, getting his picture out and seeing how many people we were able to reach through the Facebook page. And then all of a sudden, all of the information that we had put out and made public and was tough for us to make public, but we were doing it for the bottom line, to help find Sunil, became a tool that people behind their computer screens, you know, in their living rooms, were using to accuse Sunil of just horrendous acts.
Well, and I know that you took this Facebook page down, I guess in part because of all the posts and messages that were coming at you, and perhaps even how it was hurting your efforts to find Sunil.
Absolutely. As Sangeeta said, we had, you know, used the page as a place to organize our search efforts, and now it had become a place for people to, you know, just send hateful messages. And at the beginning, and in the first hours, we said to ourselves, well, we'll just take down all the posts. And we started taking it down, and it started out as a trickle, but very, very quickly became a flood. And we had 8 people sitting at computers all trying to take down posts at the same time, and we just couldn't keep up. And so we sat down together and decided that we needed to just unpublish the page for a little while.
And forgive me for asking, but how hateful were these posts? Were some of these posts?
We received a wide range, and it ranged everywhere from people just asking for more details to people being very convinced that Sunil was one of the bombers and being very aggressively accusatory and threatening.
To the family?
To the family, to anybody that ran the page, to Sunil.
And to Sunil.
And I think one thing we were most worried about is clearly for Sunil to have walked away from his life, something was really wrong for him. And at that point, we didn't know if he was just in a shelter somewhere or taking a break. And we were very afraid that the message, the language that was going out would reach Sunil, who's already an incredibly vulnerable position. And, the false identification and the frenzy, the kind of lynch mob frenzy to go after people is not new. We know this in this country since 9/11, since well before 9/11. And the fact that it's just very not careful and very painful to incredibly vulnerable people is something that we were very just sensitive to, both for Sunil and for ourselves. And I think it really, this is a very extreme story, but the message underneath it is sadly not as uncommon. And I think one of the things that we take away is that there are human beings on the other side of the internet. There are human beings on the other side of a media story, and we really need to express a lot of caution with how we use words.
And Judy, I read that there were a lot of media people, press people, calling, I guess, for interviews as well. Did that surprise you?
Yeah, it mostly went to Sangeeta and Ravi's cell phones because they had been the point people for the press. Their phones were ringing off the hook through the night. We were not answering it, especially at 3:30 a.m. I guess that's when the morning press people come. We also, at home in Pennsylvania, when we came home, found dozens of media messages there. And some were very benign. Mm-hmm. We want to talk to you about your son. And some were saying, we have news about him that you don't know. And we weren't answering them.
Right. So you gave no press interviews?
Not until the next morning.
Right.
So the next morning, of course, the suspects' names were released by the FBI at around 7 a.m. or so. Of course, that allowed us to put our Facebook page back up. We did so. We wrote a statement together to put on it. And really, with the inspiration of my 2 kids who are right next to me here, they said, okay, let's call all of the media who called us and tell them we do want to talk. We want to tell them we're still looking for Sunil.
Hmm. And were people interested in interviewing you about that? Go ahead, Ravi.
Much less so. There was a lot more. What had been at 4 a.m.
This urgent phone call,
endless,
right?
Yes, and endless sources trying to get any comment from the family became, we'll let whoever know that you're interested in talking. And it was, over the next couple days, we were able to to be on a number of media outlets, but it was much more of a concerted effort to voice our continued search for Sunil.
Right. Were there apologies? Did you get apologies from people that had either posted things online or even some of these media callers?
Yeah, so there were a few apologies that came through. One of the most notable ones was the Reddit owner of the sub thread. But I think one of the messages that we said is that it's important to apologize and take responsibility, but it's more important, A, to use your platform now in a productive way, to use the same amount of energy you used running around to retweeting things to now help us continue to find our brother. And it's also incredibly important to take a step back after this incident and think carefully about How do we prevent this from happening? Clearly, social media exists. We can't avoid it. It's part of the reality. Social media happens faster than traditional media. And so there's this weird interplay that happens where traditional media sometimes sources from social media. And, you know, this is the world that we're in. And the question is, how do we keep treating people like humans and be aware of how vulnerable you know, our young people are.
And did they take your advice, or from what you have seen, was that advice taken?
I think a little bit. I think a lot of conversations have started. We were very pleased that the Times did publish a very long story recently to help continue that conversation. And, you know, part of the reason why we're here on the show is because this is a conversation that needs to continue.
Well, let me reintroduce the three of you. That's Sangeeta Tripathi joining us along with Ravi Tripathi and their mother, Judy Tripathi. We've been talking about Sunil. We've been talking about Facebook and Reddit and Twitter. Sunil died earlier this year, a Brown student. He was on leave, had been struggling with depression, and was misidentified for a short period of time on the internet as one of the Boston Marathon bombers. It blew up, frankly, over the internet, and then almost as quickly, I guess, died down as well. We're talking about Sunil, about social media and depression as well, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I want to quote from that New York Times article. In fact, this is you, Sangeeta, saying to the Times, "One thing we've been struck by is how porous the space is between social media, the media, and law enforcement. We assume that if random people on Twitter were sitting in their pajamas saying, here's this kid missing in Providence, that's skinny, and here's something horrible that's happened because of a kid who's skinny, that speculation would be contained within a certain space. It was not contained within that certain space. It just sort of reproduced itself exponentially."
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things when we spoke with the FBI agent very early in that evening, before the whole rumor started, we all looked at pictures together. We all knew the story. We sat there and said, this is not Sunil. Right. And that was the fact. And the fact that no other facts were underneath. There's no footnotes in Twitter. You know, there's no other facts behind things that people say. And very quickly, they become bigger and bigger because more people have liked them or retweeted them. And as we know from a history of mobs and a history of groupthink, more numbers does not make it right.
Mm-hmm. But I wonder, too, when all the, and I realize this was a short period of time, but nonetheless a terrible period for the family, whether, Judy, you felt in any way you had tools to correct what people were saying about Sunil. I mean, as you said, the FBI didn't believe. They knew he wasn't the bomber. Sounds like the police knew he wasn't the bomber. But nonetheless, here was this narrative that was taking off.
Yeah, I think there were no tools at the moment. The best advice by the FBI was to close down the Facebook page. Some people took that as sort of an admission of guilt. You know, some people said, well, they took it down. That means they know Sunil's guilty. There was no way to keep up with it. It was very short-lived. We were blessed by that. You know, it was from 8 p.m. till 7 a.m. the next morning. The FBI, who had been working with us for weeks, said that had the suspect's names not been released the next morning, he was very intent on trying to have the FBI make a public statement, pretty much, you know, clearing Sunil. I mean, we had photos that were concrete, you know, evidence that they were not the same person. We did not know if Sunil were alive or not. So I think the comment Sangeeta made earlier was very much on my mind that night.
Indeed. Ravi, looks like you want to say something.
Yeah, and I mean, that Thursday night of April 18th, we were kind of stuck in a no-win situation, we felt, because there was no way to answer these media calls and say, this is not Sunil, and have our voice be heard enough to stop the rumors. And when we didn't answer the calls, it also perpetuated the comments that were being made, and so it continued through the night, and we definitely felt very helpless, and there was nothing we could do other than watch this happen, let it run its course, and try to, you know, weather it as best we could.
I mean, are there lessons learned for you? I mean, you've sort of described both the positive and the negative of social media as it certainly applied to Sunil, your brother.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very public space that, unfortunately, everything on the internet also lasts forever. So it's a very, it's a space that needs to be taken very seriously. And lots of times, I think what I saw was, you know, how much people can forget that, even though I'm, you know, sitting at a computer screen hundreds of miles away, what I am typing affects someone.
Well, and as you were saying, Sangeeta, is that there are people on the other end of the line. And in this case, this is a family tragedy.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that has really struck me, particularly in this search, is there is such a strong human desire to be connected to one another, right? And we were searching together for Sunil for 37 days. And in that search, we were literally physically sitting around a rickety dining table with Post-it notes all over the walls and maps spread all over, and people were coming, and people were hugging us, and people were taking posters, and people were hanging them. And every single day, more and more people were connecting physically together. And that's a really powerful thing, and that's a very important thing. And Facebook and all these other forums are a way to try to be a proxy for human connection. But one of the things we forget, because it's a computer screen, is that we really are still dealing with each other as humans. And so I think this whole, both the Facebook side as well as the physical search side, reminded us of really the power and the need for connection and for community. And ironically, you know, one of the biggest things that people talk about with regards to depression is how disconnected people get and people feel, and how isolated people feel. So for me, a lot of this is in the arc of how do we continue to take care of one another as communities, and reach out and lend a hand to our vulnerable people who are struggling. And, you know, I've said this a lot, but on Facebook, you see everyone's newsfeed, you see the best things that are happening in life, and you kind of forget all the struggles that people go through every day. And so Facebook was a part of this story, right? But human connection is really the real part underneath.
And Judy, I wonder, even as you look back on this obviously very difficult time, what was helpful to you? Because I think a lot of people want to know, for someone in a similar circumstance, what do you say? What do you do? How to be helpful to someone who's dealing with this great mystery? And of course, it takes on this very public perspective.
Well, there are a lot of layers to that. I think the first that bothers me the most right now is how to help young people and older people who are depressed. So that, in the dark moments when I'm lying awake, that's what I think about. I don't have an answer to that yet. We are looking at organizations and ways to help increase the safety net for people who are depressed. So that's the one layer.
Right.
The other layer was that as we looked for Sunil, not knowing where he was, what had happened, exactly what Sangeeta has said, people are good, community is important, and we had a memorial service in Providence 4 days after he was found. Students, law enforcement, administrators, Providence residents came who didn't even know Sunil. People are really good at heart. Everyone looked at me and said, I'm a parent too. And that is what I'm trying to carry away with me. I said many times, I wish Sunil could have seen that.
Indeed. Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with the Tripathi family. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Cayley Group supports WHYY, fostering and promoting traditional Irish arts and culture in Philadelphia and the greater Delaware Valley. The Philadelphia Cayley Group presents the 39th Annual Traditional Irish Music and Dance Festival. This year's festival features Tony DeMarco, Nuala Kennedy, and many other talented performers, and takes place September 12th, 13th, and 14th at the Commodore Barry Club, also known as the Irish Center. Tickets and information online at philadelphiacayleygroup.org.
About 10 gunshot victims arrive at Temple University Hospital each week. Trauma Chief Dr. Amy Goldberg and Youth Counselor Scott Charles started the Cradle to Grave program to try to stop the cycle of violence by taking young people at risk into the trauma center and describing the medical realities of gunshot wounds. We'll talk with them and a gunshot victim on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
All this week, as the consensus over what to do in Syria takes shape, we want you to be a part of it, from constituents all over the country to members of Congress, with plenty of experts each day to keep us grounded. Join the debate at 877-8-MY-TAKE and check out special coverage on Syria this week on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Just a recap here. On April 23rd, the body of 22-year-old Sunil Tripathi was discovered in the waters off a park in Providence, Rhode Island. He had been a student at Brown University, was actually on a leave of absence, and had disappeared on March 16th. He had been struggling with depression. As we have learned during this hour, his family used YouTube and Facebook during those weeks that he was missing in hopes that they would find him. But instead, Reddit and Twitter users misidentified Sunil as one of the Boston Marathon bombers. The Tripathi family telling us they were bombarded with threatening and hateful posts, in fact, fielded numerous calls from the media asking for interviews. The false story exploded all over the web and just about as quickly disappeared. We're talking with the Tripathis, and I'm talking with Judy, the mom, Ravi, and Sangeeta about Sunil, what they learned about social media, and also what can be done to address the problem of depression. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Judy, if I can go back to you, you're a Quaker. Was that helpful in this period?
I am a Quaker. It was very helpful. We conducted both memorial services for Sunil, one in Providence and one in Philadelphia, as Quaker memorial services. And for those who don't know about that, it's mostly a silent meeting where people move to speak, get up, and say whatever they're moved to say. Many of the attenders were not familiar with Quaker service, and I cannot tell you the number of people, including policemen and, equally robust types of people who came and said they cried and they spoke and they listened, and that it was a very moving way. We had students, some who knew Sunil and some who didn't know Sunil, stand up and tell their stories. That Quaker spirit was very helpful. Also, Quakerism emphasizes consensus in decision-making, and probably Sangeeta and Ravi can talk about that.
Yes, and this is consensus in terms when looking, I guess, for Sunil about what decisions to make, what to do, right?
Absolutely. In our 37-day search in Providence, we had a number of extended family and friends with us, helping us out in the search, being supportive to us. And at every step of the way, when we were trying to prioritize how to organize ourselves and how to prioritize our efforts, we would sit down and have these very long meetings around the dinner table, kind of first updating everybody and then, laying out our priorities. And at each step of the way, we were very much benefited by the many different perspectives mm-hmm. that were given, from the older generation that wasn't as Facebook savvy, that helped us kind of translate our message beyond the Facebook page to Sunil's friends in college who were still very active in creating Google Maps to help us with the search.
Yeah. Was that helpful to you, Sangeeta? The Quaker is, I guess, Quaker traditions?
Yeah, I mean, I think at its core, Quakerism believes in the power and the equal power of every human being. And I think this entire experience, I'm a very, very militant pacifist person, and I found myself having to work with police and many armed people of all different types. And, we had so many different types of people working together. And one of the most beautiful things is when you have parks workers and cops and city cops and the mayor of a city and students, you have such a diverse group of people, church growers, people who worked in shelters. We were all trying to work together to find Sunil, and every single human being was really important in the search, and it's actually really important in general. So we were truly both trying to model and live a different way
and
of
what
being
is it,
together.
And what is it to me, a militant pacifist?
I just have very different political opinions than many people who work in law enforcement. But I think at its core, even just in the search, by working consensus-based, we actually found a lot of people in our own group who were very fragile and who were struggling. And, you know, we in our spirit decided we wanted to keep holding everybody up. Mm-hmm. And I think just that spirit of kind of, instead of looking forward, looking backwards and picking somebody else up and reaching your hand out to people who are fragile, was both something that we exhibited in the search because we needed to, because on any given day, in any given moment, one of us was completely hysterical, you know, was having a bad set of moments. We needed each other in a very physical way. And I think in general, we need each other as people. There's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of hustle on young people to find a job, to find an internship. There's so much pressure. And we really need to keep taking care of one another.
There's so many takeaways, if I can use that word, from this conversation. One is, of course, what an extraordinary family you have, Judy. And on the other hand, is this need for physical sort of togetherness, and also how social media and all the tools that we have, how that does connect us to people that perhaps we would never have known and would never have been a part of our world.
I agree, and I'm not a Facebook user normally, but I totally agree with you, Marty. There's, you know, especially talking to law enforcement, when they said to us the best thing we could do is spread the word, and that there was no other way to spread it as quickly and as wide. And then the emotional part, the support, the loving, supportive words that we got from strangers.
Yeah. From all over the world.
From all over the world.
And I also read, Ravi, that while looking for Sunil, it was really just going all over Providence, going to shelters, going to sort of, combing the streets, looking for any, evidence of him?
Yeah, there was a lot of just physically looking for Sunil. What Providence Police told us was that, you know, we were not going to get in their way, and so anything that we could do would be a help, as long as we were being safe. Our extended family, extended friends, we physically walked the streets, walked along water, and visited homeless shelters endlessly, mm-hmm. and churches and anywhere else where people congregate and where we could spread the word.
Does anyone know how he died, Sangeeta?
We know that he went into the water and drowned.
And drowned.
In a park very close to the university campus, late at a night. And we know that, he walked basically 10 minutes down a street and passed other young people and adults and cars. And I think one thing that a lot of us think about a lot is the same thing I said a little bit earlier, is how fragile. You never know what is going on in somebody else's head. And when you see somebody on the street who's struggling, or you have a college friend or an old friend you don't talk to anymore because they are annoying to talk to because it's frustrating, or a family member that you kind of gave up on, you never know what's on the other side of that. And I think one of the messages for us is keep reaching out.
Yeah, but it sounds like no one gave up on Sunil.
No one gave up on Sunil.
Right.
My mother, Sunil's grandmother, talked to him on the phone that very night. No one gave up. He knew that. I pray that he still knows that.
Yeah, yeah. And what you said, and I know this is painful, and I apologize in advance, but I know that you do want to talk about depression. As you have said, this is something that is obviously so isolating for the person who's feeling depressed, and for a family who clearly loves this child as brother and sister, how frustrating it has to be to know that someone is suffering and not to be able to get to sort of uncrack that, if you know what I mean.
It's extraordinarily frustrating. And as I said before, I really, you know, there are no easy answers. Mm-hmm. Connecting with the person who's depressed is most important. But it's complicated because, in a way, Sunil was his own worst enemy at that moment, because he either, whatever it was going on inside him, he wasn't able to just open up. And, you know, he was 22 years old.
Yeah.
You know,
he's
an adult. So I think trying to be optimistic and hopeful, I think we all harp on what Sangeeta's been saying, community.
Yes.
Community.
Yes.
On a school campus, I've my pediatrician or the kid's pediatrician had attended a conference about screening, even in pediatric care, for mental illness. So I think there's a lot more that can be done in schools, on campuses, in community groups, and we are far from the answers to that.
Sure. Ravi, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, just going back to the frustrations, you know, exactly as my mom pointed out, he was 22 and, you know, an adult in the eyes of, you know, the world we live in. And it limited the resources that we were able to access on his behalf. And it also, like, this situation also exemplified to us kind of the cracks and the holes in services, you know, provided by the government, provided by a university, provided by, you know, society, kind of, that we, you know, as much as we tried, we weren't able to to overcome. And I'm sure that there are many, many other people out there who have struggled with the same thing. I mean, that's the bottom line of our story, is it's a very common story when you whittle it all down.
And I think also common when someone suffering from depression, Sangeeta, doesn't want the help. I mean, and it's hard to sort of get into their head about why they don't think they need the help or could get the help.
Absolutely. I mean, when you have somebody with cancer, you don't have a long conversation about whether or not treatment, you know, is important. And it's just, it's a much trickier thing. And one of the stats that really blows my mind is 30% of young people who have committed suicide, who have had a successfully committed suicide, never, ever mentioned suicide in the past. So the risk is very broad and wide for people who are struggling. And we are just not there yet, both as a society and in terms of the services that we deliver, to really ensure that we're catching people who are vulnerable.
Indeed, yeah. And I wonder, Judy, too, I mean, you're learning about, you're you work with diabetes, so you work in one part of our healthcare system, but you're learning about another part of our system.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you, Marty, did a show on suicide that was one of the first I listened to when I turned the radio back on when I got back to Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And that opened my eyes. One of the things I think that is most surprising to me is that I knew Sunil was depressed. We all knew it. I never doubted that he would come out of it. He denied suicidal thoughts. I never believed it could happen to him. And I think everyone in every family needs to be aware that if a family member or friend is depressed, it is a risk. And I don't know what we could have done differently, maybe nothing, but I think it's something that's important for us to talk about.
Indeed. Yeah. What are your thoughts about that, Ravi?
Yeah, absolutely. And you look at, you know, medicine these days, and medicine doesn't have an answer for depression either. You know, it's definitely very much a work in progress. And I think we'll continue to be a work in progress for a long time.
I hate the word closure, but I scribbled it down, Sangeeta, because some people think when something like this happens over time, there is some kind of closure for such a loss and for such a tragedy. Does that in any way make sense to you?
The 37 days we were looking for Sunil, there were two bodies of young men under the age of 25 that were found that were not Sunil. They were both suicides. For me, this is a very big problem, and there's a lot of work to do for our young people. I mean, the irony is the events of Boston showed how fragile our communities are. The events of our family's life show how fragile ourselves are. And I think we're just in the Syria story you just ran show how fragile world relations are. We need to keep working harder to better take care of one another. So though the search for Sunil has ended, the work that we have to do is not over.
And does that give you something to hold on to, Judy, to think that by focusing on things like depression and suicide, you can, in a sense, honor Sunil?
Oh, without a doubt. The hole in our hearts will never be filled, but we are going to Boston in a few weeks to march in a suicide prevention walk. We are talking to people. We are going to support groups. We're seeing therapists ourselves. We know that this is a continuing struggle. And basically, I'm an optimist. And I think the love that so many people have had for Sunil maybe can inspire some good work.
Has therapy been helpful, Ravi?
Therapy definitely has been helpful. It's a long road. And it's, you know, for me, I still feel it's very much at the beginning of this road. And I don't, you know, the word closure just brings about in my head the fact that I don't think I will ever, you know, this will never be wrapped up and put away. This is something that's kind of shaken my foundation and how I look at the world and the things I value in the world. And I'm hoping that I'll be a better person for it in the end.
In your medical school, I mean, has it had you sort of think about what your major is or what kind of doctor that you want to be?
I mean, it will no doubt have an impact. You know, I'm still early on in my training, so I'm not sure where it'll lead me. Mm-hmm. But I will carry it with me.
Yeah, final words from you, Cindy.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone who touched this process, whether it was through Facebook messages or bringing us bagels or hanging posters, a lot of people were changed. And I think, you know, I've been changed by just seeing how deep human generosity is. And I work in health systems, public services. And I think a lot about how do we build better systems to take care of people better and to use a generosity and a humanity that actually exists. And that's one of the things I take with me.
Well, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Of course, our regrets as well about what happened. And you have an extraordinary story to tell us. And I thank you for doing it on Radio Times. Judy Tripathi, Ravi Tripathi, and Sangeeta Tripathi. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscow. Wayne, thank you for joining us.